now plugged into the Delphi podcast.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to the Delphi podcast. I'm Tom Shaughnessy, and I help lead Delphi Ventures, as well as host some of the most in-the-weeds and thought-provoking guests across crypto, spanning Layer 1s to DeFi, NFTs, and beyond. The goal is to have fun, but also to dive deep and offer foundational episodes on projects and founders. Also, check out our research on Delphi Digital or miss out on the most compelling research there is. It's up to you. As a reminder, nothing said on this podcast is a solicitation to buy or sell any security or token or to make any financial decisions. Delphi Ventures may hold tokens mentioned, so check out our transparency page in the show notes for more info. With that, let's dive in. See you guys on the other side.
All right, guys, we're live. Welcome to another Delphi podcast. My name is John. I'm from Delphi. And today I have a very special guest with me, Emin Günsürer, the mastermind behind Avalanche. Emin, I'm thrilled to have you here. Welcome.
Very nice to be here. Thank you for having me, John.
Can't wait to dive in. First of all, I'd like to congratulate you and Avalabs team. You, like, Avalanche is a relatively new ecosystem. It started only just a little over a year. And since then, it has been showed remarkable adoption. Number of users, transactions, wallets, and everything, they're almost at all-time high right now, and they keep growing. And so big congrats with that. And I remember I was listening to one of your old podcasts when Avalanche was not a thing yet, as the meme goes. And you were saying basically that you think good tech is basically necessary, but it's not sufficient. And that your biggest fear is that you won't hit the market in timely, and then people will not recognize the big tech that Avalanche will bring. So now everybody recognized it. How are you feeling?
I think it feels great to be sitting on top of the current wave of Avalanche success. So as a community, we went very, very far in the 14 months that we've been alive. So in that time frame, we went from essentially zero. 14 months ago, mainnet had not started yet. We went from zero to hockey stick growth. Like you said, we're at all-time highs in terms of usage. We have many, many, many transactions per second that I've forgotten the counts of. I want to say it's 1 million users per month, but it might be 1 million users per week right now. The load that the chain is experiencing is about 70 to 80% of Ethereum. So we're doing 70 to 80% of Ethereum's volume, Ethereum's capacity. Our fees are incredibly low. And so the chain is ticking along, doing huge amounts of transactions. Lots and lots of users are coming in. And we have the TVL is incredibly high, at all-time high. And we have a bridge that's bridged over more than $7 billion in assets. So we're in a very, very good situation right now. And I am grateful to the overall crypto space for being able to recognize quality where they see it. I mean, I do occasionally complain about all sorts of things about the crypto space, but at least in the case of Avalanche, they did realize that, hey, this is different. It's not the usual dreck. It's not the usual copy-paste. It's not the usual, you know, flavor of the day. Oh, everybody likes layer twos. Let me have a layer two also, kind of a system. It's an actual different vision with brand new tech. The vision is digitize all things. The tech is multifaceted. It's a very fast consensus protocol of the kind that no one else has. Much different and a much faster underlying infrastructure. Bridges that are at the forefront of bridge technology. Cheap, easy to use, like wonderful, elegant. They're just great. And a vision for essentially these subnets that allows the system to grow. So the amount of transactions we can do per second across subnets is unlimited. So it's a very, very nice situation to be in. I'm so excited about what's to come in the next year. I'm very bullish about the space overall. The traders in the space, as you know, get skittish every now and then. And every time there's a slight downturn, they're like, oh, is this a bear market? Whatever. Those bear markets were back when crypto hadn't established itself. Overall, crypto is doing incredibly, incredibly well. It's here to stay. It's a new asset class. That's going to, you know, upset a bunch of people who think that crypto is all a zero-sum game. but it isn't. Value is being created on these chains. That's why people are burning all the Savax every day to interact with the chain. So it's a really nice situation to be in. I think the timing could not have been better. The chains that came after us, they did not do so well. And we started the bull market with our token sale. And I think maybe it was just timely. And then the people who came after us with their new stuff did not. Typically, that new stuff didn't really have all that much going for it. But they also haven't done so well.
So when you say Avalanche, I think pretty much everyone recognizes now the fast consensus and everybody knows about it. But I think something that is less known is the subnet functionality that you mentioned. And this is a functionality that hasn't been fully enrolled yet. And I've been talking to some community members and they have a lot of questions with subnets. So we know the general high-level vision that there will be independent subnets. Each will run one or more, one or many chains, and they will somehow interoperate with each other. If I push you a little bit on getting one step deeper than that, could you provide more color on their exact implementation? Specifically, will subnets transfer tokens with each other when they do? Are they going to be routed through a hub? And in Avalanche's case, I presume that would be the primary network. Will they support generic data message passing as well? Can you speak a little bit about those?
Certainly. So just for those of you who are listening and may not have heard of Avalanche subnets, they are a way by which anyone can start a new blockchain underneath the Avalanche umbrella. So you can say, hey, I would like to have an application-specific blockchain that is where the rules are set by me, and you can actually go and launch it on Avalanche in essentially in a few minutes. And mostly those few minutes I spent with the user fumbling with his ledger and so on. What can you do in a subnet? You can do whatever your heart desires. You can start your own virtual machine. You don't have to run the EVM. You can come up with your own virtual machine. You can come up with your own rules for validators to join your network. You can come up with your own fee structure. And most importantly, you get isolation from whatever is happening in the rest of the system. So if the Avalanche C-chain is being used heavily by a bunch of people, it's not going to affect the subnets underneath Avalanche. That's our situation. There's a bigger scenario with subnets. Now, back to your questions very directly. Sort of the model everybody should have on their minds when it comes to subnets ought to be kind of like, you know, the 1970s internet. So what is that? So back then, every university, every campus, every large institution was beginning to wire up their campuses. So what you do is you have a particular usage in mind and you come up with your own network for that usage. And then as necessary, universities and institutions started pairing up. They started what we call peering. So you can create a subnet and you control everything in it. The transfers between subnets do not have to go through a hub. So if you have a John net and I have an Emin net and John net can connect to each other. But in doing so, they don't have to transfer value through a hub. There are no centralized components in this design. Back in the early days of the internet, it was an open question how the internet ought to be structured. And there were people back then who talked about star topologies. And a star topology has a bunch of good things going for it, but there is a problem in the sense that the center of the star is a central failure point. So in Avalanche, and the thing that won out was random peering. The internet was formed through a random peering arrangement. So a similar thing happens in subnets. Now, the one thing that's important, though, is that for your subnet to interact with the public chains. So if you want the JUNnet to be able to connect to the Avalanche C chain, and that's something you might very well want to do, then you have to use the Avalanche P chain to connect your subnet to the rest of the universe. So that's the one connection. And I think your last question had to do with, can you send arbitrary messages? At the moment, subnets do not support this, but it's definitely something that's on our roadmap. You should be able to invoke a smart contract on another subnet. So there are many different use cases. I think maybe what this is getting at is, what are the use cases for subnets, right? That's really the big question that your community members must have. Let me rattle off some use cases just very quickly that are top of mind for us. Imagine that you have a very functional but somewhat costly service. For example, Dexalot. It's a DEX that's a central limit order book like DXDY. But, you know, like DXDY, it consumes a lot of gas. And, you know, we have capacity, we can run this, but we can't run, you know, you start running into limits if you have to put everything onto the same chain. So Dexalot would make a perfect candidate for running in its own subnet. You move the entirety of the smart contract to its own chain. Whenever you need to interact with Dexalot, you move your coins from the C chain to the Dexalot chain. You perform your trades. And when it's time to cash back out and go back and participate in DeFi, you go back to Avalanche C chain and continue there. That's one usage. But there are many other usages. I've been talking to a very large company that I cannot name. And let's just say that they have a lot of embedded devices, And they want to connect a lot of the operation, the main portions of the operation, to smart contracts. Now, they could do this on Ethereum, but, you know, they would have to pay insane fees. And you don't want to pay an insane fee for every, you know, parking meter or thermostat or what have you. So what do you do? Well, you need to have a blockchain that runs smart contracts where you control the fee structure, where you are in charge. And in fact, also where you isolate yourself from the load on the main network. So that's another case of somebody wanting to have their own chain. Again, we're talking to quite a few. Shouldn't really mention all this stuff, but let me just mention some other case, qualitatively different case. A very good usage for subnets is regulatory compliance. There are many people out there who have assets, but these assets are bound by law to obey certain rules that change dynamically on the fly. So they need to have reassurance that they control the entire lifetime of this asset. This asset should not just be like, oh, here's the contract, here it is up in the air, and then the creator loses control over it, and then suddenly you have a bit of a situation. You need to be able to turn to your legal team and say, I control what happens here for all time. Well, to do that, what you could do is you could say, hey, this lives on a US law compliant subnet, and every validator here knows that, you know, they have to abide by the laws of the United States. Or this thing here is a GDPR compliant subnet. And on occasion, it has to do whatever the GDPR requires it to do. So all of these are possibilities with us. Oh, and then the final one, let me mention this. Not maybe everybody, but those of you who've been around for 4 or 5 years have heard about the block size wars, the Bitcoin, big schism in Bitcoin. And everybody debated this stuff. And it comes down to some people thinking that the hardware is strong enough to change some parameters, and other people thinking that they shouldn't make those changes, and the hardware is not strong enough. They should always accommodate the lowest end of the hardware. So if you happen to be in a group where you think, hey, I want to run my entire virtual machine much faster than other people, then you can create a subnet where the validators are required to have much more resources than your regular average Joe Schmo with his laptop at home. So suddenly you can build high performance subnets where, you know, everything, the parameters are tuned for far more speed than the normal default subnet. So I hope that gives everybody some color on what we plan to do with these subnets. It's application specific subnets. It's enterprise specific subnets. It's assets that require regulatory compliance. It's performance oriented subnets. All of these are possible with the architecture that we have. And I should also finally mention that this architecture is kind of unique. It's not something that Ethereum has. It is not something that Ethereum 2.0 is going to have. It's just not something that was on anybody's radar for a long time. It's just us and two other systems that have something at all like this. So it's just us, Polkadot, and Cosmos that have anything resembling this kind of structure.
Thank you for that. That's extremely helpful. I think that will be a nice spot to transition to my next question, which is basically the enterprise use cases. So you gave some examples, imaginary examples, but you actually have some partnerships in place already, right, in this direction. So some that I can recall is a partnership with Banksy. You have this initial litigation offering use case, which is basically financing these litigations. And recently, I've been hearing that you had a partnership with TOGG, which is the Turkey's first electronic vehicle maker. So Would you like to touch upon these? Like, you can pick any of those. What interests you? And based on your experience so far, what challenges you have faced? What will it take for these enterprise use cases to pick up and actually get adopted in mainstream?
Such a great question. And there's so much to say. So I'll try to say as little as possible, but let me see if I can collect my thoughts a little bit. So first of all, yes, though you mentioned some of our enterprise connections. There's many others. There's Deloitte. There's so much. There's TOPS, you know, in the NFT space. Deloitte is a government contract actually involving FEMA, the emergency service here in the US. So there's so much to talk about, but let me sort of abstract out. Let's take a step back. And I think the takeaway from any discussion in this space of Ava Labs and Avalanche, the chain, and enterprise adoption has to be the following. Unlike many other teams, we have a well-funded, very large team. And we, unlike many other teams, we are not a one-trick pony. We're not just a fast consensus protocol. We are not just a new network architecture that allows subnets. We are not just a cool bridge that uses the latest of technology to bring you cheap interchain asset transfers. We're doing all those. We're technically incredibly innovative. But in addition to all this, we are actively working to get new assets onto blockchains. The motto of Ava Labs is digitize all things. That's the vision that we have. I am not trying to go after and carve out some value from some other existing chain. This is not a game of, you know, let's be somebody else's killer. I cannot imagine a more dreadful existence than that. I am not a layer two. I could serve as a layer two. Avalanche could serve as a layer two, but that's not our vision. Layer twos are always parasitic. We are here to grow the space. And to that end, we've been working incredibly hard across the board, as you mentioned. And you know what's top of mind? Today, I've been thinking a lot about ILOs. And let me tell everybody what they are. Initial litigation offerings are a new kind of an asset. It's the first of its kind. It was issued, the very first ILO just happened a few weeks ago. It was oversubscribed. And in an ILO, what you do, it's called an initial litigation offering. Somebody is suing someone. But they need money, especially in the United States. Justice only works for you if you have money to back yourself up with. So what people typically do is they go to some centralized lender, and those lenders give them some money for the lawsuit, and then those people make some of the proceeds. And this has been a very lucrative business for those people. You and I cannot participate. You know, we're not GPs at Parabellum, the kind of companies that are doing this. Those companies are making insane returns year over year for the last 8 years or so that this thing has been in existence, because regulations just were changed to allow this. So what can you do in an ILO? ILO democratizes this field. So you or I, some normal person with a grievance who wants to use the court system, we can raise money on a blockchain. And the SEC regulatory framework, because this is the part that the people behind the first ILO did their homework, they made sure that there is some legal groundwork that is entirely legally compliant. After all, you're going to court. You cannot go to court having, you know, not complied with law. So it's incredibly compliant. It's incredibly well thought out. And the money is given not to the plaintiff, but to the lawyers, so that there's no chance of an exit scam, essentially. So the lawyers then use it for their legal expenses, and then the returns go back to the token holders. It's a fantastic idea. It's a new asset class that I expect to grow. The current size of the litigation funding area is about $10 billion. So if we do our jobs right, this can mobilize something on that order of magnitude on a blockchain. So that's incredibly high. New TVL from an entirely different source that did not used to be on blockchains before. I'm really excited about this. I'm really excited about the societal impact, because now it's going to be much, much more feasible to go after and get what people owe you, instead of having to settle because you ran out of money. So I'm really thrilled about this. There's a new company called Rival that is being formed to pursue ILOs full time. It's essentially part owned by Ava Labs, because some of the ideas came from us. But the execution is being done separately from Ava Labs. But it is happening all on the Avalanche chain because it's cheap, it's open, it's got a great community, etc. So that's where we are. It's a very fascinating journey. And there's a whole lot more that I can say about the other things that are happening in the enterprise space.
Thank you for these. I'd like to switch gears a little bit, and you touched upon layer twos. Now, the roll-up space is getting super heated, right? Right now, like
crowded. Crowded. I don't know what heated means. What is heated?
Like
crowded.
Crowded. Sorry, my bad.
No. I mean, it's okay. It's just I just wanted to point out the fact that they're crowding each other out. There's so easy to start one up that everybody's starting one up.
So basically, it's not only Ethereum community though. There are a bunch of people mind share in the crypto space that are working in this direction and have been working for many years. So, in my personal opinion, they are much simpler to implement from my perspective than previous preceding layer twos like the plasmas and channels and all that. And I know you stated that Avalanche is agnostic to rollups, but I also know that your personal opinion is that there will be underwhelming just like other layer twos. What are some reasons that make you think this way?
First of all, I think, you know, I'm at my core a scientist. And if my eyes are telling me something, then I have to observe and acknowledge reality. So I cannot live in a fantasy world. If I did, I wouldn't be a scientist. I cannot sell dreams to people. If I did, again, I would not be a scientist or an engineer. We have to look tangibly at what's happening. And so what has been happening? Layer twos are not a new idea. They've been around for, I don't know, even though 7-8 years at least. Bitcoin's been around for 11 years. I heard the first, yeah, I think about that's about right. So for around 8 years, we've heard about layer twos. And, there was Raiden, there was Plasma, there was Lightning Network, and many, many others. I built the world's fastest layer two myself. It's called T-Chain. T-Chain. It uses hardware and special hardware acceleration to be able to cut through some of the trust issues involved in that require heavy crypto. And so because it doesn't use heavy crypto, it's supremely fast. And my conclusion after using all these is that layer twos are inherently flawed. They are not the right path forward. I kept saying this. I mean, as you said, with my Avalanche hat on, I have to say, you know, my whole team says, Gun, shut up about layer twos. You don't need to say anything against them. But the scientist in me just has to call out what I see. And what I see is it's a flawed vision. You can make layer twos work somewhat, but deep down, they face some fundamental problems. Problem number one is the fact that they fracture liquidity. So suddenly, instead of having one chain, you fracture the liquidity on the chain, the value on the chain, into multiple disparate systems. And a user now has to go and interact differently with each and every one of these chains. That's a big problem. A second issue with layer twos is that essentially what they break is the simple, elegant abstraction of regular, uniform interaction with all of the entities on a chain. So instead of just going to Ethereum and doing whatever it is I would normally do, now I have to worry about what chain this thing is on and what layer two this thing is on and interact with that. And some combinations are not possible. DYDX, because it's on one layer two, cannot interact with flash loans that are somewhere else. Not only is the liquidity fractured, but the protocol itself is different and you cannot atomically go from one to the other. Layer twos are just blockchains. At the end of the day, you're interacting with a chain. And that layer two has a whole bunch of problems related to the entry and exit of funds. So look at any one of these layer twos, and now you've got an issue where when you want to take your money out, some of them require a 7-day waiting period. This is insane, right? It not only broke the user experience, but it created an impediment to growth. I can just go on like this. Like there's so many problems, but I'll go on actually. So another problem with layer twos is they bring no value to the underlying chain. They are all parasitic by nature and inherently. Why? Because essentially they're there to come and cannibalize whatever value is on a chain and move it elsewhere. They are just another blockchain. And yeah, okay, they play nice with an underlying chain, but that's kind of like, you know what, I'll come back to this and I'll give you the correct analogy for layer twos. I'll give it to you now, actually. So there are reproductive strategies among iguanas. Some iguanas are proper males. They look like a male. They're black and red and yellow, and they've got the male markings. And if you are one of those, then you have to fight the other males. You have to establish a rock for yourself, and then you have to guard the females that actually bask on the same rock. And that's what most of the iguanas do. But some other iguanas, when they develop to maturity, they don't display those characteristics. They don't have the black and red and yellow markings. They look like females. And their reproductive strategy is to not fight anyone. They just want to slowly walk on to some other male's rock and then copulate without being seen as a rival. And that's really what's going on with these layer twos. Even though they are a separate blockchain, they are pretending to be a friend to some other thing and trying to cannibalize. They're not, typically the layer two teams don't have a business development team. They're not expanding the space. They're just cutting into whatever's underneath. And so again, you know, if I were to look at what's happening with layer twos, the data availability problem is enormous. It's significant. The entire point of a layer two is, okay, well, the layer underneath doesn't have to know what's happening in the layer two, right? Instead of having 1,000 transactions on layer one, we move all 1,000, we take money out, we do 1,000 at layer two, and then we settle back down onto the layer one. That's fine, except whenever there's a dispute, there is suddenly a huge problem. Now, the layer underneath might have to know quite a lot of information to settle the dispute, and that creates issues. The ZK rollups are far better in this regard than the other ones, but this data availability problem is really at the core of any scheme where the underlying system doesn't get to know what happened. It might very well be the case that data gets lost. And I'll remind you that there are blockchains out there where some of their blockchain data is irretrievable. They lost it. There was a system-wide screw up. They were fairly centralized at the time, and it's gone.
I think Ripple was one of them, if I remember correctly.
Ripple is definitely one of them. So this is it's an issue, and this can happen to layer twos in the blink of an eye. So these things, this is a fragile technology, and as a developer, if somebody were to give me a layer one that works versus a layer two that's built on top of a layer one, and it's surrounded by many other layer twos, I wouldn't know which one of those layer twos to pick, and I certainly wouldn't go in that direction. It becomes a Frankenstein monster. My trusted computing base for my application is now huge. Not only am I depending on Ethereum, but I'm also depending on whatever layer two got built on top. So this whole thing is just, I think it's, and I've been saying this from day one, layer two based scaling is just no scaling at all. It's just punting the problem and saying, we just can't solve it anymore. So, you know, as I said, we are agnostic to it on Avalanche. You know, I would love to see some layer twos deployed on Avalanche. Why not? They will be deployed on Avalanche. I know that for a fact. But, am I thrilled about it? No, I don't think it's going to. I mean, people will see that it's just, it's going to turn out exactly like all the other layer two attempts in the past.
Very, very interesting take. Thank you for sharing your insights. And this is super valuable.
Thank you for the rant. You got me to rant. Every now and then a techie will rant on a topic. You know, I'm very passionate about these things. People don't have to agree with me. It's okay to believe in layer twos, and you can still believe in Avalanche. It doesn't affect the Avalanche narrative at all. But, you know, you ask my opinion. This is my opinion. I think they're a dead end.
Thank you for sharing your thoughts here. So let's talk, let's dive into Avalanche consensus a bit. So I'd like to also, like, as a techie, I'd like to dive in a bit. So bear with me and please correct me if I say something wrong here. I'd like to speak about the Avalanche consensus, and especially C-Chain consensus. C-Chain was built on Snowman consensus initially, and Snowman is a novel consensus algorithm. It's blazingly fast, and it doesn't have any leaders. Basically, anybody can propose a block, and there is some sampled voting process. And at the end, where everybody asks some random peers, and then basically decisions are finalized. But basically, as economic activity on the C-chain grew, we saw that there were many blocks that were each competing for the same height on the blockchain. And basically, the motivation here is to basically get your transactions first on the blockchain. As a result, we saw some transactions slowing down, and Avalabs basically had a solution to fix this, which is the upgrade, which is an optimization over Snowman, which is Snowman++. And Snowman++ was super effective in solving this, but it also introduced the concept of designated block producers. Do you think, in your opinion, was this a step away from the like an open leaderless nature of Snowman, or are there some nuances that they may be missing here? Would like to hear your thoughts on it.
There is nothing that conflicts in between those two things. So yes, it's absolutely true that we added an optimization within 2 weeks, I must say, after noticing a problem. What was the problem? The chain was open to attacks from people who wanted to get their transactions in ahead of others. And it is essential to us that we provide a great experience to everybody who uses our chain. We are not religious extremists. We are not going to be fanatical. And most importantly, we are not frozen here. We're not unable to move. Unlike most other teams, we will move and unapologetically. We will change the protocol to make sure that our users are not harmed. It is absolutely essential that we not allow anybody to jump in between you and your trade on Pangolin, on you know, Trader Joe or whatever. So to actually facilitate that, what we added was a very simple optimization. It simply says within each slot there is a designated block producer who has who has a slight edge in placing a block into that slot. So that doesn't mean nobody else can, but it just means that the network prefers that this is your turn now and somebody else's turn next, etc. This is exactly the same mechanism that lies at the heart of many other protocols as well. They do it in a much worse manner by actually narrowing the number of people who can actually vote even in a block. But in the case of Avalanche, everybody votes on every block, and this goes round robin, and everybody gets a say. Everybody gets a turn to be a block producer. So I don't think it compromises any of our principles. The overarching principle here is provide the best experience. Don't allow users to get exploited. And so to that end, we will do whatever it takes. I will work really, really, really hard to make sure that I come up with, or my colleagues come up with, whatever innovation is necessary to protect the users. And anybody who says that that's a mistake, you know, they can go right off to another chain and use it where those mistakes are being committed daily. And, you know, the MEV has to be minimized, that's extracted by other people that are coming in. And the harm to the users must certainly be minimized as much as possible.
I mean, objectively, it completely solved all of these user experience challenges.
Let's be clear. It wasn't, I mean, yes, it did. That's not to say that MEV is zero on Avalanche. So let me add that as well. So there are still cases where people actually can jump ahead of you, etc. So that's okay. We will one by one address as many of these as we can within the confines of our technical infrastructure and provide, you know, continue to provide the best experience to users. And this really is a big differentiator. If I may, let's take a little detour. You know, a lot of the teams, a lot of the projects, they differ in their technology. And how much do they differ? Well, you know, a lot of these guys are copying each other, so maybe not all that much. Avalanche differs very much because we introduced a new protocol, we have a new implementation, etc. But you know, and they differ in terms of applications they've got, and that's also narrowing down. But what matters most is the philosophy. And the Avalanche philosophy is different. We are really product-oriented. We're really user-oriented. And I make absolutely zero apologies for any optimization I introduce that makes the world better for my users. So I know that there are some extremists out there who are like, well, you shouldn't have done that, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You know, that's okay. Well, we did it. The community adopted it, and it was a huge change for the better. It was the right thing to do. And I think other people will now begin to realize, hey, these guys are playing this game right, and they will try to emulate us. But I'm proud of having been first in this.
That, I think, was pretty clearly communicated in the bridge solution that you offered in the second bridge solution, which is now like there's one bridge, but the old one was basically had not so smooth user experience. But the new one was, when I first used it, it was so smooth, like it was fascinating. And I can definitely tell that it was a much, much better user experience than the things that we witness in crypto.
Yeah, you know the reason why for that? It's very simple. We are using a technology that nobody else had used for anything of substance, as far as I can tell, before us. And so this is the Intel SGX technology that's used in our bridge. So the bridge is a trustless bridge. Even if the bridge operator decides to steal the funds, they cannot. So, and the way this happens, it's using this thing called an enclave that's found on Intel processors. And the code is tamper-proof in the enclave. So there's some code that runs on the bridge node that is known by a bunch of wardens. And the wardens ensure that the code has not been tampered with. And so the users have the assurance that the code will behave according to spec. So, this is this SGX material, you know, the SGX capability hadn't been mobilized at all in the blockchain space. Nobody was using it for anything. We were the first. It's not easy to use. It requires a different class of expertise. And again, we brought it there. In fact, I brought students that I had taught at Cornell how to use the SGX into this project to solve that problem. So I'm really proud of our team for being so innovative, and I'm really proud about being the first. The bridge does allow anybody to transfer assets out of Ethereum with just one transaction. Just send them to the bridge address, and then they magically appear on the same address on your address in the Avalanche C chain. So you pay one Ethereum fee, and then thereafter you are subject to Avalanche. Things are much faster. Instead of taking many, many, many seconds, they are instantaneous within a second. And transactions themselves cost something around $1 to $2, as opposed to hundreds of dollars or more at times. So I'm really proud of that development. And again, that's a differentiator for us.
I'd like to also hear your opinion on execution environments, now that we talked about subnets, custom VMs. EVM is obviously pretty dominant in this space right now. There are many chains that adopt EVM. C-Chain is one of them. Do you think this EVM will remain to be the dominant form of execution in the blockchain space? Or could there be other more scalable VMs that we see that will emerge? And I'll add one more question to that. Is Ava Labs working on a custom VM implementation?
Well, the last question is an alpha leak. So, can you leak some alpha? Okay. All right. Let me see if I can answer your questions without leaking too much alpha. So let's see. The EVM is a virtual machine that I happen to love to bits. I come from the Ethereum community, and the EVM is the de facto standard. People who do not start with the EVM have a very hard road ahead, because they have to suddenly get a whole bunch of machinery built, a whole lot of tooling built for their custom, whatever language they're using for their smart contracts. So if you're doing your smart contract writing in Rust, there's nothing wrong with Rust. Rust is a great language. I'm a fan of it. But there is a problem in the sense that the tooling is not necessarily there. The auditors are not there. you might think this is a problem. This is an overlooked problem. I know of teams who've written things in Rust. They can't get them audited because there's nobody who can do that. Well, this is the people who can do that are very busy, and there's nobody that they can find who would do the audit. So these are all issues. And what does happen with any kind of technology like this is, for a decade or so, everybody coalesces onto the same platform. So we're on the EVM platform right now for smart contracts. I'm really happy about the fact that anybody who knows Solidity can use the Avalanche C-chain. And I'm also happy to be in a nice relationship with all of the other EVM chains. We are all helping the Solidity network grow. We're all helping a community form around Solidity-based smart contract writing. And that's a wonderful thing. The network effects are real, and it helps expand the space. So I'm really happy about that. Now, the other question is the EVM perfect? Absolutely not. There are so many decisions that were made in the design of the EVM that I certainly would not have made. And they go from the lowest level decisions all the way to high level stuff. So what's low level? The size of a word. You know, so the 256-bit primitives are rather large. That's not how I would have started. The fact that safe math is not default. That's kind of weird. The fact that I'm mixing up Solidity and EVM a little bit here. The fact that the data layer, data management layer, is so convoluted and so complicated with the Patricia Trahi and so forth. These are all issues that get in the way of a good, fast implementation. So there are many, many, many things that I would love to do to the EVM if I could start over. So that's what I can say. Your final question is, are you working on this? So the only thing I can say is, there is no fundamental question related to blockchains on which we are not working. So of course we are. So ask me any question that seems important. There is definitely somebody that's in the Avalanche community working squarely on that topic. So, this includes, are you working on new languages for writing smart contracts? Absolutely. Are you working on new VMs? Absolutely. Actually, I can say that. I've said that before. That's public knowledge. We're working on new VMs that are far more efficient for specialized use cases. Are you working on anything else, related to security of funds, etc.? Yes, of course. And whatever is important in the space, we are definitely looking at it. That's what brought us here, by the way. I was a professor, and I was looking broadly at the space and addressing the big fundamental problems to the best I could. And that's how we came to where we are. We will continue to do that.
So, okay, I'll ask you then another question. Are you working on state bloat? Like state growth.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We've got super pruning in the works. Now you'll ask me what that is, and I will then start to engage you. But I will. It's because one of my colleagues, Kevin Sekniki, ended up leaking the fact that we're working on super pruning that I get to even say what it is.
I love him. He always leaks all the information in Twitter.
he's like a sieve. He's like a sieve. He's leaking alpha left and right. And it's a known thing in the company. Sometimes people tell me things and they're like, please don't tell Kevin. So just because they know he will leak. That's true. We are working on it. Super pruning is very important. State bloat is a problem. And I know that there are many other techniques for reducing state bloat. The one that we're working on we call super pruning. It's a complex matrix of options.
For those who might not be as familiar, could you iterate on this problem, the state growth problem, a little bit?
Sure. The problem is simply that as you have a blockchain that executes for a long period of time, it accrues state. So, suppose there is a contract there and you interacted with it and it made a mark of the fact that you interacted with it, or you hold a token. Well, then that token contract has made some kind of state marking about you holding that token, and so on. So these things grow and grow and grow to the point where when it's time to perform an operation, you might have to be performing rather deep lookups, rather complicated lookups that consume a lot of cycles. And that's at the heart of the state bloat problem. There are many things that one could do if one could redesign the EVM. And then there are things one could do without redesigning the EVM. So yes. And you will be seeing super pruning in the year to come, in our current year, rather, in 2022. It's going to be fun because, and super pruning helps also with a whole lot of other secondary problems or tertiary problems, like startup time. So fast sync and super pruning are both, you know, complementary tricks that work well in tandem.
Looking forward to see them. Very interesting. It's not a problem specific to Avalanche by any means. It's a problem for pretty much all blockchains. So
it affects Ethereum the worst, right? Because it's been around the longest and has accrued a lot of state. So it's definitely a problem worth solving.
So we've talked a lot on tech side. I also would like to hear your opinions on topics that would be like more relevant to a broader audience. That is basically crypto critics. We've seen many uneducated criticism against crypto, like this is all tulip mania, it's all going to go zero and all that. So I'm not interested in that. But what are, in your opinion, you spent years in this industry, and what do you think like the valid criticisms are? Like what are some challenges that needs to be better addressed as a crypto as a whole, in your opinion?
I fully agree with you that there is a lot of uninformed criticism out there. There's a lot of criticism that comes from people who form their opinion too early. And they keep saying things like, this is a zero-sum game. You can only make a dollar if somebody else brings in a dollar, etc. Those are false. This is it's an area that offers services, and many of them. There are hundreds of services. There are 500-plus different really major smart contracts on top of Avalanche alone. There are so many of these things that actually provide value that people are actually burning millions of dollars a day to use these chains. So that's, I'm going to discard that like you did. So what are the valid criticisms? I think one set of criticisms that are valid comes from the fact that there is hidden centralization behind some of the services or coins or tokens or assets in the space. Stable coins being the biggest problem point. I think there are a lot of people who are tether truthers. Right? What's a tether truther? This is somebody who does not believe that every tether is backed by a dollar. So, and in fact, a few years ago, I was in this category as well. I was like, well, you know, these guys promised an audit. They haven't delivered an audit, so what's going on? But I have come to change my opinion. They got the mother of all audits done by the Southern District of New York, the district attorney's office here. And if you can withstand that audit, then you can withstand any other audit. So, and I know Paolo fairly well by now. And I believe that operation to be working really well. But, you know, there is an open question here. And there is the fact that some people will never be satisfied with any answer to this question. So the lawmakers are currently looking to come up with some regulation for stablecoin issuers. Once that regulation comes out, I think it would be a huge service to the space. Why? Because it will shut these people up. If done well, it will shut these people up. And suddenly we will not have to worry about, you know, is every X or Y or Z backed by da 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 da. So, you know, I never know this for any of the companies on Wall Street. I'm looking at Wall Street right now. I don't know that what they say they hold on their balance sheet, they actually really hold. Every now and then, you know, one of them implodes. It's always a problem. We do need a regulation, I think, in general for Wall Street, because they work on trust. Services that rely trust or rely on custodians in the crypto space should be subject to a little bit more scrutiny. I think I can live with that. And so I think that would be good. So that's a real concern. Second concern of mine, again, a big one, are the centralized exchanges. Nobody knows what happens on these centralized exchanges. There is insider leakage. So when you trade, the fact that you traded, you took positions, is leaked through a whole complicated network that you and I are not a part of, or may I don't know,
oh,
you
I'm
are,
definitely
but I'm not a part of that network. But you know, when Justin is buying or when Justin is selling, the people who know this, they profit off of it, and so that's a bit of an issue. I don't know how to stop it. Liquidations, how they happen. people with big chunks of money doing stop loss hunting. So they dump a coin, lower the price, cause people to sell, then they buy it back at a low point and essentially just wash people out of the system. I mean, people can do this and they can get very rich doing it, but in the process, they drive people away from the space. So that's my second big concern. We need more trustworthy exchanges. But, okay, hang on. So let me just slow down a little bit. The same crap happens on Wall Street as well. You know, it's in fact part of their business model. Citadel jumps ahead of everybody's orders. They do all sorts of funky things to make sure that you get worse execution than you would otherwise. So it's not like these problems don't exist in the real world. They of course exist there, and they exist also in crypto. The difference here is by the magic of the underlying blockchain underneath us, and plus, you know, the magic of crypto, we can actually come up with solutions that solve this problem. And so we can go to Wall Street and say, look, for years you looked down on us. For years you said your exchanges are not trustworthy. You're too volatile. You're this, you're that. Well, now the tables have turned because our exchanges are better than yours. You guys can barely keep track of the number of outstanding shares of the Dole company. Go look up what happened about 6-7 years ago. They lost track. They ended up, you know, a whole bunch of people ended up thinking that they have shares, 53 million shares, when there should have been 38 million. So you can't even keep track of the number of tokens you've got outstanding, and we have a very different technology that's better than yours. So those two problems are the two major things I can name off the top of my head. There are others also probably, but those are the two big ones, I think.
Yeah, these are very valid points, and yeah. Thank you for those. Like, hopefully we'll see more and more activity on chain rather than off chain in these exchanges. Yeah, and it'll be good for everyone. So I think we're close to wrap this up. Like, thanks a lot for coming in and sharing all these very insightful thoughts. And I'm thrilled to have you basically today. Before we close off though, I know there will be an Avalanche Summit in Barcelona on 22nd of March. Would you like to say a word or two about that?
Yes, it's going to be epic. Our first big summit, Avalanche Summit, is going to be held on the 22nd of March in Barcelona. Come join. It's going to include a whole bunch of talks on tech. It's going to include a whole bunch of talks on business use cases. It's going to include a bunch of talks on all sorts of other things, regulatory to whatever else, to social. It's going to be fun. It's going to be educational. You know, we're going to run it. I want it to be an enrichment, you know, an event where people leave enriched in some way, fashion or form. So it should be kind of like going to a workshop, a technical workshop in your chosen area, whatever it might be, where you come out having learned something. And I'm super excited about it. I cannot wait. It's the timing is good with, I think Omicron should be completely gone by then. It will have burned out, and travel restrictions should be lifted. I cannot wait. It's going to be fantastic. I'm really, really excited to have a face-to-face meeting with the global Avalanche community.
Nice. I'm going to be there for sure. I can't wait to see you in person. So, yeah.
Great. Likewise. It would be great.
All right. I think we're good here. So thanks for joining, Emin. This was a pleasure.
Likewise. Thank you, John, for having me.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to the Delphi podcast. If you enjoyed it, please support the show by hitting subscribe on your podcast app, writing a review, or sharing this episode on Twitter or LinkedIn. Stay tuned for our next episode, out soon.